The outlook was beautiful under its sickle moon. It hung out next to and partly over a waterfall. Two long blocks of rooms, two stories tall and covered with balconies, looked out over the spill. At the center, a great A-framed prow of glass and rough-hewn timber arched like an eagle's head. The carpeted inside was hunting lodge overlain on luxury hotel. Clean as an operating room, it even smelled like evergreens within. A small army of staff in jet black with immaculate white aprons scuttled around at the edges of the rooms and corridors. A clerk in a neat gold-buttoned black shirt and pants admitted them, verifying their presence on an old computer. Valentine tried not to stare. He couldn't imagine Southern Command wasting a functioning computer on a hotel, but then he hadn't spent much time in the higher-class social circles. The clerk issued them alligator clip name tags with first names and designations. Gide had her name in large letters and volunteer militia in smaller type below. Valentine's read, David/Delta Group. He tried to decline having a porter carry their small bags, but when the clerk said, "It's his job, sir, he needs it," he relented. Luckily, the script he'd won on poker night was accepted at the Outlook. He overtipped the porter as the bags hit the floor of their room.
King-sized!
Old beaver traps decorated the walls, and the lights were made to simulate ironmongery holding candlesticks. The candlesticks were topped with small but ordinary-looking bulbs. A painting of a farmhouse surrounded by wildflowers adorned the wall above the dresser. A nude of a strategically disrobed seated woman drinking hot coffee, looking out her window at ice and snow, hung next to the bed by the window. Another sleeping nude hung above the bed. If it was a brothel, it was the plushest one he'd ever been in. Valentine checked the view. The waterfall was obscured by a deck from their room, but he had a good view of the river running west. He tried to guess how high it went into the opening mini canyon below the falls and the spring flood, but even with cat eyes, it was hard to judge.
Cocktails, dinner, dance party.
Gide read a schedule on the desk.
Looks like we missed cocktails and part of dinner. Tomorrow, breakfast, exercise, lecture on the glory of heroism, games, cocktails, dinner, party. Sunday, services, brunch, departure.
Valentine despaired at a grease stain on his uniform. He must have brushed against a greasy pot in the wagon. There were two galleries showing movies on the biggest televisions Valentine had ever seen, colors impossibly bold and bright in the dimly lit rooms. A small casino added that special, thick, nervous air unique to gambling dens, and some kind of art exhibition was going on in one of the lobbies, well-crafted patriotic pieces that Valentine liked better than the four-color slogan posters of Southern Command. Attractively dressed women lounged in the bars and in front of a gallery auto piano, ready to talk or dance or be taken back to a room. Valentine watched one military haircut man in civilian clothes head for the rooms, his hand resting lightly on his companion's buttock. Valentine examined her eyes as they passed. She popped or smoked something to get up for the evening. Valentine suppressed a shudder. He kept expecting the maitre d' from the Blue Dome to appear at his elbow. Gide, now dressed in a borrowed little black dress and heels, eyeliner running up the backs of her legs to simulate stocking seams, tracked down a late-night buffet and they ate.
I poked my head in the gift shop while you were looking at the pictures. Nice booze. Perfumes, even.
Bonded whiskey. But they can't get you a decent set of boots.
Speaking of which, there's a shoe store on the gallery. If you loan me $30, I can sign for the rest. I have to hurry. They close in 10 minutes.
Valentine gave her the cash. He went out on the balcony and enjoyed the summer night, watched the roar of the fountain. He fell into a conversation with another falls gazer, an artist in an ill-fitting sport coat and trousers.
My piece is called Hope and Glory. I won a new moon party here with it.
Valentine quietly raked his memory.
The two rising, what are they, angels?
He seemed pleased that Valentine had remembered. He started talking about the difficulty of getting good paints when he looked up.
That's Adler. He gave a quick talk at the reception for the artists.
Valentine looked up at the peak of the A-frame. There was a small balcony hanging over their own, and muted light glowed within. A man stood looking over the edge, his face in shadow thanks to the backlighting. He turned and leaned, and Valentine got a better view. Valentine liked the look of him. tanned, maybe the altitude of the outlook helped, and lean, but not gaunt, with gray-white hair that set off the tan, a father figure in the twilight of middle age stood looking at the western horizon beyond the foothills of the Cascades. He held a lit cigar in his hand. Late-night diners trickled out of the dining room and joined in the waterfall watching. Gide returned, wearing low black-heeled shoes and real stockings. Adler set down his cigar on the railing. It rolled, and he stopped it with a digit. He called down to those below.
Liquor holding out?
A few men raised their glasses. A couple applauded.
I'm here for the night air, not a speech. Enjoy.
He lifted his finger, and the cigar rolled off the balcony rail. A mutton-chopped officer in a black dress uniform grabbed it as it fell. By the time Mutton-Chops was showing his trophy to his escort, a blonde who had the body of a 17-year-old and the eyes of 35, Adler had vanished indoors.
He's shy. I like that.
Valentine looked out into the clear night, wondering what the shy military genius had been looking for to the west. Sulfur-colored light painted the distant clouds above Seattle.
I thought you were going to buy boots.
They had returned to their room. The bed had been turned down, and the room carried a floral, elegant fragrance.
I did.
She pointed to a box.
Socks, too. Lots of them. Great quality. Picked up a few pairs for Julia. She loaned me this dress. I'm not really fitting.
Who's Julia?
My roomie. She takes a little getting used to. She was born a slave to some grogs in Oregon. They caught her poking around in a larder and chopped off her nose with a set of tin snips. Though she's always joking about it. Really a jolly person once you get to know her. When she goes out, she wears this silk veil and calls herself the Phantom. The guy gave me a great deal on the shoes because they were used. You can hardly tell.
Valentine looked at the label in the bottom, something in Italian, as he took off his tunic. It added to the air of fantasy in the lodge.
They spritzed the sheets with lavender water.
It's supposed to relax you.
They had tabs of horny in the gift shop. Can you fucking believe it? KZ aphrodisiacs? Here?
She let her two-tone hair fall, though the roots were now coming in an even walnut brown, and flopped back on the bed, her hair spread out like a fan. Valentine adored her for a moment. Her hard-bitten, tattooed beauty, her profanity, and the military acronym somehow complemented one another. But a moment was all he allowed himself. Much more in his self-control would go.
I think I might take a walk before I shower.
Going to buy some horny?
You wish.
He winked. Her upper lip twitched rightward.
I'm not so sure anymore.
The cool, clear air took the lavender out of his nose and replaced it with the mountain smell of pine and cedar. Valentine walked out in front of the resort, where a winding road ended in a dark oil slick of the parking lot. In the distance, the green light of the military checkpoint glowed. At one end of the lot, by a couple of bright outdoor lights, insects flashed like shooting stars as they whizzed by, a drunken game of pickup basketball proceeded noisily. Valentine watched the players try to dribble with one hand and hold a beer with the other, then turned toward the river. He caught a little music from the small dance club at one end of the outlook, but even that was soon drowned out by the quick-flowing river, rushing out of the mountains in a white froth. Some kind of cable contraption hung over the waterfall downstream, a gondola basket providing both a crossing for the river and a unique way to view the spectacular falls. Valentine saw motion across the river, just a sentry out to have a look at him. He returned to the patio. Most of the parties had broken up. A few people still smoked or chatted over hot drinks in the chilly air. Valentine had to remind himself it was June, as in the mountains it felt more like an Arkansas March. Valentine couldn't shake the feeling that something bad loomed out there, watching the hotel. He turned over in his mind ways he might try to assault the place. There were sentries at the door, and Valentine suspected some kind of security reserve lurked in the basement, as he'd seen uniformed soldiers disappear into the doors marked "Service Use Only" leading down. Or was he just talking himself into a breakdown? Not enough stress in this getaway, so you have to bring some along? Or are you scared of what's in that king-sized bed? He undressed and got into bed quietly, the vast bed giving him a margin of error. She rolled and faced him.
This is different. I'm glad you brought me.
Nice to have a familiar face around.
She took a deep breath, closed her eyes.
Good to be just in bed with a man. Lavender and guy. Someone needs to bottle that.
What'd you mean when you said that you weren't so sure anymore?
Curiosity had got the best of him. Or maybe it was a game he was playing with himself, with her as the prize. Or the other way around. She thought for a moment.
I used to just be able to turn everything off and enjoy fucking. But I'm starting to know you better. There's a lot of stuff in there I think I like. That weird little smile you wear.
She touched the corner of his mouth. What the hell? He reached up, took her wrist, kissed her gently on the back of her hand, then turned it over and kissed the palm. He released it, and she reached up to play with his hair.
Shit, now I've done it.
She lunged across the bed as quickly as one of the snakes tattooed on her arms and kissed him. The rest came in a frenzy of pent-up desire, effervescent as champagne and just as intoxicating. Valentine woke with a start in the pre-dawn. Reapers. He found he was sitting up, listening in anxious silence. No, the strange cold place on his consciousness wasn't there, wasn't real. It was echoes of memory and nightmare.
You okay?
Cramp.
You're sweating.
Yeah, I'll be right back.
He washed his face in the bathroom, still listening. Then he went out to the balcony, looked around at the darker-than-ever world under a pinkening sky. He heard someone sweeping on the balcony below, smelled fresh bread, the feminine musk of Gide on him. He returned to bed and slept hard. They spent the rest of the weekend mostly in the bedroom, trying something Valentine had never experienced before. Room service. Saturday passed in brilliant sun and wandering clouds, and they restored themselves from bouts of lovemaking with coffees and teas on the balcony, sitting on an old bench with one of the bed pillows cushioning their backs. Gide, like her father in his better days, was also a big reader, and they poked through worn yellow-paged books collected from the hotel's small library together. They dressed for dinner, and later discovered a second night together more delectable than the first. They hitched back west on Sunday, riding in the bed of a King Cab pickup carrying a trio of captains who reminded Valentine of one of the poker hands that brought him up. Saying goodbye to Gide was hard. But like all such days pried from the routines of war, the brevity made the memories that much sweeter. 4 days later, he saw his first action. Courier duty, they called it. Valentine buzzed out over Seattle's waters in the dead night, low and slow as he dared. Any watching Reaper might mistake him at a distance for a fast-moving patrol boat. They'd modified the exhaust of the Pat to lower the noise and make its voice resemble the oversized motorcycle it was. Valentine sensed a slight loss of horsepower, but it just meant he couldn't do much in the way of fancy climbing turns. The entrance to Seattle's harbor now had two tall lights marking it, constructed from old radio masts. The north rose up from an island, and the other was on the coast. Allegedly, some poor bastards made the long climb to the top of each 4 times a day, keeping watch on the water approaches to the city. He wondered if they'd mark him as a potential smuggler. Valentine kept well clear of the southern tower, but used it as a waypoint. He picked up a little altitude over the southwestern peninsula, saw the 3 lights, 1 blue and 2 red, laid out in an equilateral triangle. 2 of the lights went out as he passed overhead, leaving only the blue. He banked the auto gyro and made his approach. Heart pounding, he set the craft down on the little field by the signal. He was on a grassy flat next to some manner of drainage canal. Foundations of cleared houses lay under a carpet of weeds, and young pines shielded him from a road. A man left 2 companions, one with a rifle, the other with a big sporting bow, and ran up to the craft. Valentine popped the canopy.
Stop!
Light!
The stranger hurried up, face concealed behind a scarf and a hat pulled down to his ears. Valentine reached around and took out the duffel bag. Whatever was inside didn't weigh much more than plastic. It rattled vaguely as he handed the sealed case over.
There you go.
Tell him not to worry. Plenty of heroes on this side of the sound.
He offered his hand. They exchanged grips.
I'm sure there are.
He handed over a heavier case that probably contained radio equipment or explosives, and the man hurried off. Valentine checked his map again. His next waypoint was the old SeaTac airport, but he was to keep well south of it. They had searchlights that could blind him and guns that could bring him down. He shut the canopy and gunned the engine. As he bounced away across the field, the men were already picking up bicycles and hurrying to meet over the bag. He marked a little flag and some piled up dirt at one end of the field and rose in the air. A target on a post flapped in the sea breeze. They'd met him on a rifle range. The flashes of gunfire looked like sparks from the air. They left little ghosts on his retinas for a split second. Valentine had never seen a battle from the air. The sporadic gunfire seemed to be coming from spots along a long, ragged line, stretching over perhaps a mile and a half of ground. They were fighting in what looked like a residential zone, long lines of what he guessed to be post-22 housing. From what he'd heard, a good deal of the southern areas of the city had suffered badly from earthquake and volcano damage. He passed over a street filled with bodies, tightly packed, around a pair of buses. The bears must have caught reinforcements arriving in a deadly ambush to have the corpses laid in windrows like that. No wonder the Seattle Guard didn't care to take on an action group. Valentine's orders were to check in at that action group's field headquarters for the operation. He could evacuate up to 2 wounded on the stretcher fittings added onto either side of the pat. It would be a hard load to fly, because carrying one meant carrying 2, or the unbalanced autogyro would crash on takeoff. He hoped that if he had to carry 2, they'd be of similar weight, preferably both light. The action group lit the road he was to land on with headlights from the reserve armed truck force. 2 smaller dune buggy-like craft, one with a recoilless rifle and the other a heavy machine gun, crouched at the intersection with the command Hummer pulled into a half-collapsed brick storefront. An observer and a temporary aerial had a precarious perch at the steeple. Remember to refuel if you've got wounded. Remember to refuel if you've got wounded. Of course, the high-octane gasoline they were supposed to be carrying with the medical inflammables was probably misplaced. He puttered the autogyro up to the command vehicle. At the other side of the half-collapsed building, the white medical bus idled, the men sheltering in a doorway. Valentine popped the canopy and got out, the sweat on the back of his uniform turning cold in the night. He did see a wounded man, his arm dressed and in a sling, waiting by the command vehicle. Valentine wondered if they'd demand that he be flown out, just to test the system. From the other direction, soldiers herded a group of civilians into a dark recreation center, judging from the basketball courts and running track outside. They kept them jogging, despite the age of some of the men, several of whom were gasping for air and supporting themselves on the runner in front. A sudden burst of gunfire sounded in the distance. Valentine extracted his carbine and approached the command vehicle. He was waved in by the man with the long night-sighted sniper rifle keeping watch on the road. He found Thunderbird there with some of his sub-officers, talking intently to Rafferty with a non-com behind carrying 2 rifles. Rafferty had his helmet off, showing his ringlets bound up like a hairy handle sticking out of the back of his head. Behind Thunderbird, they'd set up an easel with a carefully drawn map. The radio reports were translated into visual form by putting red slashes over depictions of buildings. Some of the slashes had been turned into an X. 2 corporals relayed information over radio to the officers.
Bravo block cleared, 81.
Bravo, 81.
The ruined building had once been a hair salon. The man with his arm in a sling tried leaning back and resting his head in a debris-filled wash basin.
Scouts are reporting traffic on 515 southbound.
Rafferty will pick this up tomorrow, you dumb bastard. I told you I'd court-martial you.
He turned to the men at the radios, clicking his tongue in thought.
Sound recall to all teams. Delay red column if possible.
Recall, repeat, recall.
Recall, repeat.
Tell the scouts to mind the roads and haul ass.
Valentine saw a camouflage-painted pickup truck roar up the road. 2 soldiers in back sat in a sea of children. Baby carriers with squalling infants stood in a crash cage. The sergeant marched Rafferty out.
Rape.
Anything for me?
Thunderbird looked startled for a second.
Oh, Valentine. How was the drop?
Completed.
No, we're good. You can get out of here.
A long rattle of gunfire from across the street dropped Valentine behind cover, but no bullets zipped the headquarters. Valentine saw the athletic building the civilians had been run into, alight with the reflection of gun flashes. The hell? Were they ambushed? The men at the vehicles guarding the headquarters didn't so much as change the covered arc of their weapons.
Gamma Gamma 44.
Gamma Gamma 44.
The lieutenant drew a big X on the map. Valentine blinked. He'd just put an X through the athletic building. Yes, 3 concrete apartments around it in a U. Jesus Christ.
What kind of op is this?
We're clearing this housing complex. D-O-E-R.
Valentine heard isolated shots as the executioners in the athletic building finished off the wounded.
T
Team Kostwald is loaded and leaving.
An officer made a note on a clipboard.
Of what?
Destruction of enemy resources. Can't stand to actually see a doer?
Enemy resources? You mean the population?
Without a population to feed on, the Kurians pull out.
Valentine looked at the X's on the map.
No objections, I hope.
His subordinate officers tensed, and Valentine saw the man with the busted arm shift his rifle around.
Objections? Hell yes! For starters...
Hop off your high horse, Valentine. Clearing operations work. Your old man invented him, after all.
The enmity that sprung up between himself and Thunderbird turned into a wary truce back in the Warren. As there was nothing Valentine could do on a battlefield, or a multi-block killing floor, in his mind, without getting arrested at the very least, he'd followed orders and flown back to Grizzly Ridge. He took the precaution of landing at the fuel depot to refuel, found Gide, and had her guide him up into the hills above the motor pool to a vacant house with an even more vacant garage. She sensed that there was something wrong and asked him about it, but Valentine didn't want to explain, couldn't without following the cowardly urge to flee the Cascades entirely. But flight wouldn't save any lives but their own. He trotted back to Grizzly Ridge, explained that his engine was misfiring and being maintained back at the motor service yard. He had written up both a request to see the Lifeweaver and a letter of resignation from Delta Group by the time the column returned. He waited outside Thunderbird's office and told him that unless the request was immediately granted, the resignation would follow. In all probability, he'd resign anyway, but Valentine didn't add that. He needed the interview. That rated 6 clucks of Thunderbird's tongue, then an order to return to his quarters and get cleaned up. Valentine hadn't slept since he set off on his courier flight. 40 hours now, he corrected himself. Someone knocked on his door.
Yeah?
Valentine wondered if he should shave. No, the sooner the better. Shaving wouldn't make a difference one way or the other. He opened the door. Thunderbird stood there with two of his bigger bears. Thunderbird walked him to one of the big gurney-sized two-door elevators that served the medical center. Shielding the control panel with his body, the colonel pressed buttons using both hands.
I think we got off on the wrong foot. I figured you knew about your old man's solution.
Valentine didn't want to ask the question on his mind, and luckily the elevator stopped and he had a brief reprieve as they met two more bears at a duty desk in a rough-hewn, unpainted tunnel. Under bare bulbs projecting from boxes linked by a conduit, Thunderbird handed over an order sheet and he and Valentine turned in their IDs. Thunderbird checked his sidearm, and they submitted to a pat-down and being wanded by a metal detector as one of the bears spoke into a phone. A woman in a medical uniform appeared at the duty desk.
He'll see them.
Pass 9-9.
The bear shouted down the hallway.
Pass 9-9.
The big bear sat down opposite the duty desk to wait. Thunderbird and Valentine walked down the darkening corridor, following the woman in white, the bulbs becoming less frequent and finally giving out. Valentine spotted an old hunk of armored vehicle crammed into a turn in the tunnel, a turreted gun that looked like a 30mm cannon covering the tunnel back toward the duty desk. Two layers of thick metal cage kept the bears inside, Valentine guessed there were two, but it was hard to tell, at their station. Valentine saw a portable toilet between the layers of cage. They turned the corner past the dug-in vehicle and came upon a set of bars worthy of a rhino cage, a small door in a heavy frame offering access to the other side. Valentine heard dripping. The medical officer fought down a yawn, took a key looped around her neck, and put it into a lock at the half door. They crouched to pass through. There was another turn ahead, and Valentine felt the space and light around the corner through the transmitted drippings.
I want to see him alone.
Don't try anything funny. If the medical staff calls, I'll come in and put an end to you.
Maybe.
The medical officer looked at Thunderbird, who nodded.
Take him in.
She looked Valentine up and down.
You look tired. You okay?
Fine.
Now, don't be nervous. He's just a bit eccentric. Remember, he's not human.
I've met them before.
She took Valentine into a grotto was the only word Valentine could use for it. It was warm and humid. Banks of what he guessed were grow lights fed thick ferns, palmettos, rhododendrons, and other plants Valentine hadn't seen since he'd been in the tropics. Off to one side, a pool, fed by a sheet of water coming down the wall that most people would call a leak rather than a falls, moved quietly, stirred by some unknown current. The banks of plant boxes and platforms made something of a maze, but the medical officer guided him past the pool and into the center of the plant life.
What's his name?
She led him past a bank of purple flowers. Valentine heard a bee buzz. Something was wrong with that, but he couldn't remember what.
He said we couldn't pronounce it. We just call him Sir. It's quick and easy. Don't let his appearance throw you off. Remember, it's just a show.
She came to a gauzy tent. She lifted a flap.
David Valentine to see you, sir.
Valentine saw a hairy mass and several sheet-covered floor mats within.
Enter, Sojourner.
Valentine went into the tent. Enough light from the intense bulbs penetrated the thick white gauze to make him feel as though he were inside some kind of cottony womb. The creature within made a startling contrast to the whites and pale greens of the sheets covering the mats on the floor. The lifeweaver looked like a half-demon, half-satyr, right down to thick, hairy legs hinged like a goat's. Overlong fingers and toes, with nails that weren't quite claws, displayed delicately painted mysterious glyphs. Pointed of ear, flat-nosed and slant-eyed, it was barrel-chested but thin-hipped, covered with limp, stringy, dirty hair, and the odd bubo about the neck and groin. Valentine couldn't say whether he was faced with a combination of legends or nightmares.
Sit.
The creature, called Sir, gave an artful wave of the wrist and overlong fingers. Valentine was reminded of an exhibition he'd once seen after his return from Nebraska, where a martial artist showed how to use a war fan.
Cross-legged is best for your kind.
Valentine sat. It reclined on one of the mats, lounging.
Speak your mind, Sojourner.
Why do you look like that, sir?
The medical officer brought in a wide, water-filled bowl. A candle and some flower petals floated within. She set a small stainless steel cup in front of Valentine.
Suits the profession. Suits all of the profession. War, famine, disease, and death. All I've known, watching these thousands of years. It's all that's left of me. I stayed on, you see, though others left after the old battles of your ancestors' time. I stayed and watched, for I loved and admired you. But I'm afraid it's driven me a bit mad.
He smiled, showing brown and green teeth.
Valhalla awaits, if you have the courage and survive your ordeal.
Sir reached out with arms that thinned as they extended. Valentine felt the greasy touch of its hands, the prick of its claws as it cradled his head.
You will be death, destroyer of worlds.
Sir's voice seemed to come from right next to his ear, despite the fact that his head remained on the other side of the tent. Valentine broke away from Sir's grasp.
Wait, I think there's a mistake. I'm not here to become a bear.
The arms pulled back.
Not a bear?
No, I need your help. I'm from Southern Command.
He wondered just how much of this the nurse was hearing.
A wolf once, now a cat, and more in your blood besides.
Valentine didn't bother to ask for hows and whys.
They need the help of the Dawim.
I never accepted that title. We were right, not backward.
The shape blurred and returned.
Southern Command, where is that again? Argentina?
The Ozarks. Texas, parts of Oklahoma now.
Mississippi River, oh yes, of course, Louisiana Purchase and all that. One of your better specimens, Jefferson. Though I've only known him second hand. I met Washington once, a good man and true. You're not fighting with the Britons again, are you? You've got to settle these squabbles yourselves, or you'll never get anywhere as a people. Our own's fault, of course. If they'd only stayed the course and not become addicted to slavery. It's like an opiate.
Valentine wondered how to drag Sir's mind back out of the lost millennia.
We need your help. I have to get in touch with the other Lifeweavers.
That can be dangerous. Very dangerous indeed. I can't take that step without revealing myself in the process. Never mind the danger to you.
I know it's a lot to ask.
Do you ask?
Yes.
No matter what the consequences, the possible harm?
I would think that would be your decision, but it's important.
Not my forte. Not my forte at all, but I'll try.
Thank you.
Sir slipped out one side of the tent. Valentine wondered if an all-out assault on Grizzly Ridge would be entirely a bad thing. The medical officer poked her head in.
You got him all stirred up.
I hope that's all right.
He wondered if Thunderbird would bust in and start beating him to death with a shovel.
Well, he needs the activity. He lies around too much. Not that we really know what's healthy for his kind. How do you feel? Hot yet? You should have another...
I'm fine. Wait, I think there's been a mistake. I didn't come here for an invocation.
She blinked.
No?
She knelt and looked at each of his ears, folding his lobes back to peer behind.
Well, that's a relief. But that's all he really does for us. Just a moment.
She disappeared. Soon, Sir returned to the tent.
Success!
He held a small, slightly curled rubber tree leaf in his hand. Valentine saw a small green stone on the strange presentation leaf.
Took some time to find the right one. Ready?
For what?
To speak to our kind. You needed to communicate with us, yes?
Yes.
This will do the trick.
He passed the leaf to Valentine, waddled around behind, and put his hands on Valentine's shoulders. The hands turned into tentacles, soft, grasping, veined leaves at the ends.
Just touch it with your fingertips.
Valentine looked at the shard of jade. Some kind of hieroglyph of a bird was carved on the side.
I'm ready, if your ka is. It's quite painless.
Valentine reached down and touched it. It felt like ordinary jade, cool and smooth. The wave of voices overwhelmed him. Incendiary butterflies opened their full-spectrum wings in his mind, and he spun around, looking for a way out, but the voices... He opened his eyes. Found he was lying on one of the mats. The medical officer hovered anxiously, Thunderbird behind. Sir looked at him, eyes narrow and calculating.
Are you still with us, David Valentine?
Valentine felt as though he were in another time and space.
I think so. What does that thing do again?
It's a touchstone. It opened up your mind.
Nothing made sense.
It takes a great mind to comprehend a touchstone on contact. But everything you need to know is...
The medical officer put a hand to his cheek.
He's hot. Sir, is he entering up as a bear?
No. I simply opened the channels. He shouldn't have the biological resource... Wait. Design, help us. I forgot. Oh, me. Your father was a bear, I believe.
I think so.
Sir licked his lips with a pustule-coated tongue.
You may have had the talent passed down to you.
The medical officer looked at Thunderbird.
We better isolate.
Thunderbird nodded, hurried off out of the grotto. Valentine heard a plant crash to the floor.
Oh, and he needs calm now more than anything. Oh, me. I've been a fool, careless. I expect he'll go mad. We said I was useless, and they've been proven right again.
Tell Thunderbird.
Valentine felt like he was floating away on a river.
Danger. Sir, you revealed yourself. Don't forget.
We'll take care of it. What's that about?
He's confused. He must have thought, I had to take my true shape to guide him to the right part of the touchstone. Make sure it didn't rush in all at once, you know. I meant the danger was to him, not to me. Oh, this has been bunkum and confusion from the first.
I'm going to sedate him.
She yanked a big white case from within a stand of ferns and opened it. The needle squirted something on Valentine as she positioned it above his arm.
I doubt it'll last.
Long enough for him to get on the gurney.
Valentine, disoriented, half awake, and anxious, didn't even feel the needle going in.
Don't let him get up! Don't let him up!
A weight pressed on his chest. Valentine saw light bulbs passing above, one after the other, each leaving a snail trail glowing on his retinas. His heart began to hammer. Something was in his mouth. He bit down. It snapped. A tooth gave way. And then a convulsion. Even though he felt that he was lying on his back, someone still managed to clobber him across the small of his back with what felt like a baseball bat. His arms and legs forgot how they worked. He smelled eucalyptus.
Zap him again!
The gurney's wheels chattered as they passed over the uneven surface below. Valentine felt calm and collected, even as his body jumped under another jolt. The world faded away, but whispered to him that it would be back, new and improved. Madness, fighting in vain against tentacles, bludgeons, ropes, the world had turned crimson and black. Shadows surrounded him, baying like a wolf pack. But above and behind it was singing. The most perfect singing he'd ever heard. An angelic choir, majestic. He sang along as he fought, until he sagged in exhaustion. He awoke to find himself in a dark room, his arms bound around his waist as though he were mummified. No, straitjacket. It was a straitjacket, made out of thick leather. His legs were swathed in some kind of padding and buckled down flat. He sensed he was lying face up, somewhere underground, but beyond that he could tell nothing, except that he felt dirty all over, particularly itching and filthy between his legs.
Hello? Thirsty. So thirsty.
A presence at his side. He felt a plastic nozzle enter his mouth.
Get ready to swallow, okay?
Gides. It was Gide. He nodded, vaguely aware of tubes and wires connected to him. He suspected one of the wires could give him a jolt. Water, just a tablespoon or two, went in his mouth. So salty it tasted sweet. They repeated it twice.
Good.
It wasn't Gide. Valentine felt a gap in his teeth on the upper left side. He probed with his tongue, felt a missing tooth, or rather the stump of one. The other felt good and cracked. The next day, at least they told him it was the next day, he could sit. The tubes were gone, but he still had wires running the length of his body, individual ends attached to forehead, Adam's apple, chest, stomach, a couple more on his back. They hung off the bed and met at a black box. He had the run of a two-person berth on the hospital floor. It was in the security wing. The doors were solid steel, hinged on the outside and closed with what sounded like a heavy bar reinforced by bolts dug into stone beneath the linoleum. The man in civilian clothes sitting opposite, under two painted panels masquerading as windows, didn't have many answers. His name was Holmes, and thanks to burned and reconstructed skin, he looked like he'd been freeze-dried and rehydrated. He spelled it as he said it, though Valentine could read it on his ID card.
How do you feel?
Better. I had eggs and oatmeal for breakfast.
Well, you're on soft foods until those teeth get taken care of. Tomorrow or the next day.
Has anyone figured out what went wrong?
Nicely put.
Clearly put.
You were a pig who wandered into a bacon factory in hopes of speaking with the management. But when a pig visits a bacon plant, there are obvious hazards. Sir doesn't direct or guide or advise this freehold. He's used strictly for creating bears.
Who are you, Mr. Holmes?
I help new bears with their adjustments to transhumanism. You're an interesting case, though, Valentine.
Why's that?
Well, sir didn't do anything to you. Well, anything much. To the life weavers, the human body is like a big, locked-up factory with all the switches turned off. How we got that way, well, I'm not going to go into various theories. I'll leave that to the philosophers.
Valentine felt a little jolt of recognition. Holmes talked a little like the general who'd offered him a choice of death or the possibility of eternal life in service of the Kurians.
Are you feeling all right?
Yes. Closed factory and all that.
Now, throughout history, a few individuals have managed to turn on bits of their factory on their own, transcending normal human limits, like some of the great athletes, or with mental discipline, astrophysicists and yogis and the odd musician and so on. Some combine the two. I'm told there were martial artists who could do the same sort of tricks you cats can. Now, of course, when the life weavers go into the factory and turn on a couple of machines, sometimes it takes the mind a little while to catch up and learn to channel the new outputs. That's where I come in. And were you aware your crystal spark-snorting mother sucked off drovers and station bars to get her fix?
When your old man wasn't beating her to it, what's the deal?
That's the fascinating thing.
Holmes reached under Valentine's bed by the black box and tore off a piece of paper covered with squiggles.
A little stress peak when I questioned humanity's origins. A bigger one, a good deal bigger, when I insulted your mother. Another bear, fresh from his invocation, would have jumped out of the bed and started pounding me.
I take it your job has a comprehensive benefits package?
Well, like you, I'm a fast healer. Plus, they learn an important lesson when they calm down, and it sticks. and they become more receptive to my training.
He lifted an object that looked like a flashlight held backward with two small silver prongs.
Besides, a quick jolt calms you down. But you? You've been controlling yourself and your reaction since childhood, I'm guessing. You've got straight pipe, so to speak, in the brain-body connection, but you've managed to install a muffler yourself. I wish we knew more of your early childhood.
I remember fighting a lot with my sister.
Did you ever hurt her?
I can't remember exactly. Just kid stuff. She'd start swinging, but since she was littler, I had to take it. Mom was always separating us. She'd sing to calm us down.
Memories returned, vague yet powerful blasts. Mother's leonine bronze face as she held him down, blood on her upper arm.
She'd sing to calm me down.
Whoa there, Valentine. You're spiking again. And it's gone. Remarkable. A ramp like that should lead to a red line, and you pull yourself back each time. Your father was... And there's another spike. Perhaps I should leave off your family for a bit.
What about the touchstone?
Holmes tapped his thigh with a scar-covered hand.
We don't know.
The sir?
Depends on the state of his mind when you speak to him. I understand at one time he was one of the Life Weaver's leading lights on the study of humanity. Followed our civilizations very closely. But he's old now. Very old. And he's slipping.
How did he end up here?
In the mess of 2022, he and a few other Life Weavers revealed themselves to the government. They went to a secure area at Mount Omega, but weren't much of a practical help. Meaning they couldn't deliver on the magic bullet everyone keeps thinking will get rid of the Kurians.
There's stuff that helps, like Quickwood.
Somebody showed up with a couple of seeds of that stuff. I have no idea where it's growing. It's a big secret.
So, did the other Life Weavers leave?
Seems like. I'm told they kept trying to pick up stakes and go elsewhere. They ended up breaking out somehow, about the time I was born. All but Sir. And no one really knows what happened next. The other Life Weavers had vanished. But I wonder. About the time they disappeared was when we first started hearing about this Uber-Kurian in Seattle. Some people say they defected.
Defected?
I think it's bunk myself. Adler says he thinks they were captured and the old King of the Tower used them to increase his power.
Valentine felt exhausted, but he forced a few more words out.
How does he do that?
We're still working on figuring out how bears can grow a new lung back, but not a hand. You ever seen a grown-back bear limb? Looks kind of like a flipper. Some of the guys have doctors tie the nub off so nothing weird grows back.
Valentine sagged back into his pillow.
You need some food, I can tell. I'll get someone to bring you a tray.
He saw the dentist, a chattering type who covered all the discomfort with a steady stream of talk. He offered to cap his teeth with ground-down reaper fangs, a popular option for Delta Group's bears. One soldier, who had lost his upper lip and a good chunk of gum line, replaced all of his uppers with reaper fangs. Valentine declined. Nights passed in weirdly vivid dreams, swirling mist that formed into wells and towers, only to dissolve a moment later like a sandcastle falling to a tide.
Think I might get a little fresh air today?
Holmes was now dividing his time between Valentine and two fresh bears in a cell next door. Valentine heard a good deal of screamed profanity, not quite as eloquent as that of the engineering crew and the old Thunderbolt, who had practically cursed an iambic pentameter as they overhauled an engine, but a good deal louder.
It would do you good. Colonel Thunderbird will probably send a couple of men to keep an eye on you.
When he went next door, Valentine hopped out of bed, tried a few stretches and push-ups. His old leg wound gave him hardly a twinge, though usually a long spell in bed left it more sore than ever when he used it again. But even that small amount of exercise left him ravenously hungry. He called for food, and a nurse gave him a heaping plate of brown rice and dark beer, pushing it through a notch under the door. He scraped his plate down to the last rice husk, listening to Holmes encouraging the bears to calm themselves by mantra. In this case, the old itsy-bitsy spider song every child picks up somehow or other. Hearing snarly voices talking about spiders traveling up and down waterspouts got him thinking. Holmes must have given him an enthusiastic recommendation because they released him the next day into the charge of a stiff-legged old bear named Yarborough.
Machine gun bullets, both legs.
As Yarborough talked, he eased his way down the corridor with a cane carved from Reaper femur. Yarborough took him up to the bear cafeteria and watched Valentine consume a vast meal of potato-heavy stew.
Tired. Very tired.
He wiped up the plate with a heel of warm bread. He was only half paying attention to Yarborough. His mind was on the layout of the elevator, in particular the bumper at gurney level.
You'll get used to it. Little exercise helps. Want to throw some pins around?
Maybe a walk outside.
Yarborough looked doubtful.
I was nervous as a colt my first time out of doors. You might panic and try to take down a truck.
I've got it under control.
Yarborough lunged with both hands across the trays. Valentine found himself 6 inches backward, heart thudding away, and nonplussed.
Grr?
I think Sir is slipping. Even a week after my invocation, I'd have been trying to open my head like an M22 if I were you.
Can I ask you a question, Yarborough?
Fire away.
What happens to the little kids?
Yarborough's brow came down like a guillotine.
What do you mean?
I saw a truck full of little kids, too young for school, babies, pulling out after the last clearing operation. What happens to them?
They go to orphanages, poor souls. Some up to Canada, some out east or the other side of Rainier. You know Eagle, right? He came out of one of the orphanages. Went in older than most, even. 10, I think he said.
Valentine didn't know Eagle, but relaxed. He'd been worried they were used as Reaper bait. Or worse.
How about that walk?
Sure.
The cafeteria was starting to fill up with the lunch crowd. Bears hurried to pile their trays with a rice flour bread and mulligan stew. Thunderbird and an adjutant came walking in as they approached the door.
Valentine, a new man I see.
Tired as an old one, but I'm gonna try a walk above ground if that's okay.
Sure, be good for you. Stop by my office when you feel yourself again.
How about tomorrow instead?
Valentine couldn't say whether he'd ever be himself again after witnessing Pacific Command's bears in action.
Anytime. Door's always open, you'll remember.
Valentine took his walk on the flattened valley floor at the foot of the ridge. He tried balancing on one of the train rails that led to the big unloading station in the tunnel-like terminal, though he'd never seen or heard a train come in. The breeze felt good on his face, but clouds screened the sun. Yarborough watched him from the bench at the headquarters shuttle pickup. Valentine took a short run about a third of the way up the hill, and Yarborough opened a box marked with the network phone squiggle. Puffing a little, Valentine reached the halfway mark on the ridge and hurried back down. His bad leg twinged, but stayed steady on even the steep slope of the warren. He ran to the train cave mouth, saw a big wire gate inside, and ran back again.
Good to get some air.
Yarborough nodded in agreement. An engine started up, and Valentine saw a flag-draped coffin inside a black horse-drawn station wagon pull out of one of the tunnels. A big plastic wreath was propped up in the empty, hoodless engine compartment, and the driver steered the horses through a missing windshield, but otherwise the wagon was black and polished right down to the tires, which gleamed and smelled like gun oil. The engine noise came from an honor guard riding behind, rows facing each other on benches in the back of an open pickup.
One of the new bears. Poor kid burst his heart. Doctors don't catch everything.
Valentine lined himself up next to Yarborough and followed form as he saluted as the station wagon hearse passed. It was just about the first salute he'd seen since coming to the Warren. The escort passed, grinding along in bottom gear.
They dye the horses black. Don't see what difference the color of the horses makes when you're standing before that golden throne getting judged.
I'm worn through.
Keep drinking water. Lots of water helps. Let's head down.
Yarborough dropped Valentine in his original room, told him that he looked healthy as a horse, then went doubtful as he remembered that the last horses they'd seen had been drawing a hearse.
I'm going to sleep. If you're supposed to escort me to dinner, give me a break and knock softly.
Valentine hadn't been back since his appointment with Sir. He checked his weapons, which were all still there, along with his ammunition. Someone had picked up his rifle and accidentally snapped shut both buckles on his pack rather than the one. He took out his razor-edged boot knife and opened the seam on his mattress, tilted it up, and shook it. He felt around through the hole, came up with his coin belt. More to give himself something to do than out of guilt at the vandalism, he closed up the seam for the second time with needle and thread from his sewing kit. Then he turned out his lights and rested. soft knock woke him, but he didn't answer. Yarborough was right, though. He was thirsty. He drank and whiled away the hours, dozing on and off. In the bustle of sentry shift change at 11 p.m., he slipped out the door, gear crammed into an enormous Pacific Command duffel with his bedding peeking out at the top. He went down to the laundry, checked in with the attendant and got tokens for the machine and put his sheets in. He wandered, grabbed a couple of pieces of fruit from an elegant porcelain bowl resting in the small library on the same floor as the laundry, and returned to put his sheets in the dryer. Someone else would have to take them out of the dryer. The attendant didn't notice him extract his duffel from between a couple of machines and exit again. He ducked into the library again and took off his boots. He went to the elevator bank and was momentarily frustrated when he found it occupied by a couple of bored technicians carrying toolboxes. If they noticed his socks, they didn't say anything. He got off at his own floor and then idled, waiting for another. This one was empty. He punched the button for the second to the top floor, climbed up to the rail, and hung on in the corner using his toes. He opened the service access on the roof, picked the lock with his hairpin like Jimmy's, praying that the elevator wouldn't stop on its upward trip. He tossed the duffel up through the gap and made it to the elevator roof. The rolling gears and cables pulled steadily, their companions to the counterweight on the other side vibrating. Valentine didn't want the elevator to stop at the top floor. A bell sounded in the corridor whenever the elevator arrived to alert the sentries that someone was coming up. He climbed to the next level easily enough. Rungs were built into the shaft for workmen, firefighting, or a loss of power. Using his gun flashlight, he examined the top-level door, found the trip for the bell. He lifted the latch on the door at the top level and just cracked the door so he could slip through. Valentine tucked his stiletto into his sleeve and listened, checking down the corridor toward the machine gun post exit. A sentry sat at a junction of rough-hewn tunnels, reading a book. Nothing to do but bluff. Valentine strode down the corridor. The sentry lowered his book.
B-Aerial crapped out. I'm checking the connection before making a big issue with service.
Valentine didn't know if there was such a thing as a B-Aerial, but it was quite possible the sentry wouldn't either. The sentry stood, didn't reach for his rifle, but put his hand on his pistol holster.
We need a...
Valentine drove the outer edge of his boot into the sentry's midsection. He dropped his knife out of his sleeve and poked the sentry hard under the chin.
Last thing I want to do is hurt you, friend. You make me open up your carotids, it's gonna bother me for days.
Valentine relieved him of his pistol and was happy to see a pair of handcuffs on his belt and a taser.
Stay flat on your face, spread eagle. I just got invoked a couple days ago and I'm twitchy as hell. What's your name?
Appleton!
Valentine gave Appleton careful instructions, and in 3 minutes he was handcuffed and stuck in the big duffel bag, with his bootlaces tied together and threaded through the grommets.
I'm gonna leave your rifle with a handcuff key near the exit. You can work your way out of this pretty easily, I should think.
The sentry was breathing a little steadier now, listening.
I'm gonna be looking around for a while from the exit. Any booby traps I need to know about?
No!
While I'm looking around, if I hear you moving around, I'll come back and tase you. Way I see it, you've got two options, Appleton. You can be a good soldier and work your way out of the bag and ring every alarm in the Warren. Someone might ask you why you didn't hear the elevator bell, how I caught you unprepared and got the drop on you.
There are patrols outside. If they shoot on sight, you try going down the west side of the ridge.
Don't worry about that. Your other option is to ditch the bag and play dumb. I hear alarms going off and they catch me. Well, I'm just gonna have to tell them I caught you jerking off with your belt around your ankles.
I wasn't!
I know you weren't, but I'm a good liar. Think they'd send you to Punishment Brigade for that?
Don't forget the alarm on the hatch. It's just a switch on the side of the battery.
If I were you, I'd get out of the bag, inch my way down the hall, uncuff myself, and go back to my book. But then I'm a deserter.
Valentine remembered the alarm, gave Appleton a little bit of a poser by sliding the handcuff key down the rifle barrel, and cracked the hatch to the air defense post. A drizzle that felt like it was too tired to work up into an actual rain slicked on his face and hair as he negotiated the Warren slopes, making off down the eastern side. He marked no activity on the road rail terminus. The Warren might as well have been a graveyard, but that didn't mean eyes weren't watching from doors and sentry posts. Valentine made a long elbow and knee battering crawl to the bottom of the slope. A garbage pit gaped 50 or 60 meters away. One of the more common punishments for minor infractions was a spell either digging new space for garbage or covering up whatever the scavengers, human, rodent, or insect, left. He rested and waited. Headlights glowed. A motorbike leading a car approached the checkpoint. And Valentine took the opportunity to make a dash for the garbage pit. Half expecting a warning shot, if not another bullet through the thigh, he was there by the time the vehicles reached the gate. On the other side of the garbage pit, the woods began. A fence ran through it, but it was militia backed up by a few bears. The fence was little more than a polite warning, and the patrols were a training exercise, and Valentine had heard stories of paths to sneak out and go into town for a little fun. The tough part was getting out of the warren. Valentine crept up on Guide's fueling station and motor pool, having gone over another fence. There were a couple of guards at the gate, but the rest of the buildings were locked up tight. Valentine rejoiced in his luck when he saw a woman Guide's size work a crank, pumping fuel from an underground reservoir into a 50-gallon drum. Then she turned. The woman's profile was a straight, horizontal line, flat as a building.
Julia.
She stepped away from the pump and reached for a sidearm.
Who's there?
David. I'm a friend of Guide's.
The David?
She reached for something at her throat. She pulled up a plastic nose and a surgical mask. Valentine walked up and shook her hand.
You make me sound like a statue.
I'm sorry. Guide's not on duty till 7.
Can you get her, please? It's really important.
Ah, love. Where are you storing your white horse?
It's Desert Tan, and it's what I needed to see her about.
Burb.
She employed the local slang for be right back and went off toward a long building that looked like two separate pre-22 houses that had been enlarged toward each other until they joined. She returned alone, as though from a trip to the bathroom.
Meet her in the tomato stands, far end of the garden.
Valentine found her crouched in the tomato patch under an oversized umbrella. She'd brought a blanket and smelled like freshly applied scent.
Lousy night for this, you know. It's damp. You could have given...
Sorry, it's not that. I do mean sorry. Guide, I'm getting out of here.
Huh?
This place is poison.
What? Sodomy and the lashback in the holes, too? And you an officer and all?
No, they're fighting... They're squeezing the Currians in Seattle by getting rid of the population. And I mean getting rid of, not relocating.
Jeez. Poor bastards.
I've done what I needed to do here, sorta. And I'm getting away.
David, you're creeping me out here. Those sheeple are gonna get it one way or another. Might as well make sure the towers don't have them.
Don't tell me you knew, too.
No, you just told me now, but fuck, it makes sense. We're what they need, right? Why let the bloodsuckers have what they need?
Valentine felt his cheeks go hot.
You used to live under them. Your whole life, pretty much.
Yeah, and I'd rather have been shot or hung or whatever they do than let some fucking hisser get his hook into me.
If she could just see it as it took place.
I'm getting out. I'm gonna report to my contact. Maybe change something, I don't know.
Good luck with that. Me, I'm bucking for the regulars. There's a shooting tournament soon. You can win a month-long trip up to the wilds for some hunting and training. It's a great way to get noticed.
There was an edge to her voice, but she blinked hard several times.
Then this is goodbye.
He gave her his stire.
Maybe this'll help you win the competition.
She cradled the gun on her knees, the oversized uniform shirt making her look like a beautiful but well-armed garden gnome.
Can't we sleep on it? Maybe it'll look different in the morning. We can talk. You're smart enough to see reason.
The last thing Valentine wanted to do was kiss her, but he found it happening all on its own.
They'll come looking for me, and yours is the first bed they'll check. If they ask about the gyro, play dumb. I need to steal some high-octane gas off you.
Let me put my boots back on.
A lace broke as she tied it.
Fuck! I'm supposed to be tough. I've been through... But you drop your guard just a little bit. It's like you never learned in the first place.
She wiped her eyes, buckled her belt.
I'll help you get the cans over the fence.
Mount Omega. So many legends have grown up around Mount Omega that even its mention lays a shadow of doubt over any narrative featuring it. Certain facts are not in dispute. Mount Omega had its genesis in Fitzhugh's folly when the asteroid ZL-624 had its near-Earth encounter. Poor Dr. Donald Fitzhugh. While two other astronomers actually presented the case at the secret government briefing with him, their names weren't quite as euphonious with folly, so they dropped out of history and the high-level panic surrounding ZL-624's approach. It was predicted to strike early in the second decade of the 21st century, somewhere between the Mississippi River and the Azores, and Mount Omega was hastily constructed with equipment from the nuclear waste storage facility in Nevada. Even after fresh tracking data predicted a near miss, Mount Omega construction continued. It was a massive, well-funded project already underway, employing thousands and thousands of highly paid, security clearance construction workers and technicians across rural Washington and northern Oregon. An 11-month, money-is-no-object crash project stretched out into its second decade. Mount Omega eventually worked its way into the defense budget as a secure location for government officials in case of a catastrophic terrorist strike on Washington, D.C. Work on it never ceased, but the project was never really completed. The Kurian onslaught of 2022, with the civilization-shattering mix of seismic activity and the rabies virus, led a skeleton crew of key elected officials, staff, and support personnel to receive their orders to relocate to Mount Omega. As the disaster grew, a stampede to the lifeboat Mount Omega represented began, and only after the shootdown of Flight 5X03 did planes cease landing at its little emergency strip of blockaded, reinforced concrete highway. And there, guarded by the best the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines had to give under General Roma, they buttoned up. A social scientist or a psychiatrist might make sense of some of the oddities David Valentine saw in his brief visit to Mount Omega, but if any did, their observations aren't easily found. Self-enclosed populations, as Darwin noted on his trip to the Galapagos, lead to a strange selection of attributes. Valentine himself, when asked his opinion of Mount Omega, always shrugged and said,
"Three generations of cabin fever."
"That is one darling little helicopter."
Valentine didn't bother with the lecture on the difference between an autogyro and a helicopter. He'd made Fort Omega in one long, exhausting flight with only a brief stop for refueling and sanitary purposes. The autogyro's stomach-tossing, bobbing motion left him feeling the same way he'd felt when climbing off the old Thunderbolt onto dry land, the odd sensation that the ground was swaying. Mount Omega wasn't on any map. Indeed, its undisclosed location wasn't even a mountain, more of a sheep-littered ridge on the grounds of an old Army training base, a little west of an old, spent nuclear fuel repository. Valentine simply skimmed the surface until he saw the skeletons of some stripped commercial jets beside a wide patch of concrete highway with a big Day-Glow X painted on either end, and then landed and waited for someone to come point a gun at him. Several someones did, displaying admirable handling of their old but immaculately maintained weapons. They ordered Valentine to lie down on his face, and he complied. He tried to speak, but they told him to shut up until they fixed his hands in what felt like plastic wire, perhaps ripped from one of the airliner carcasses lying by the side of the road.
"Let's have it. Why did you not acknowledge radio signal and land without permission?"
First, the radio's a piece of crap that's preset to only receive 3 Quisling frequencies. Second, I'm on Southern Command orders. Hunter, Cat. Pre-cleared to contact civilian authority. I have a verification code that I will supply to anyone with the prefix."
"Shit. Let me get someone from liaison, sir. I'm afraid you have to stay under restraints and guard for now."
He gave orders to a messenger, who double-timed off toward one of the grounded planes and disappeared up a nose ladder.
"Well, if it's gonna be much of a wait, I need a trip to the John, and I could really use a hot meal."
Valentine couldn't remember when he'd last been so hungry, and wondered if Sir had permanently accelerated his metabolism, or if he'd adjust in time.
"Understood, sir. We'll have to watch you, though. As to a meal, if you get taken inside, the food's better than what we can give you out here."
After seeing to his comfort, they started making small talk about the gyro. A 5-stripe came out to observe. Valentine heard bicycle tires and a driving chain. A tall pipe cleaner of a man in civilian clothes, brown wool trousers topped by a khaki shirt, pulled up and removed his helmet and hung it on a hook on his belt. He took a courier bag off the bike's handlebars and trotted up to the soldiers, a holster bobbing at his hip.
"My name's Patterson."
He knelt so his eyes were level with Valentine's.
"Valentine."
Patterson took out a neatly printed card.
"I'm your professional military surrender resource.
I'm completely outside their chain of command, and my only concern is for your behalf. I'm here to see that you get food, medical care, legal representation, and religious or social comfort between now and your release or execution. You understand?
I just need to speak to the liaison officer.
One of the older waiting soldiers spoke under his breath to another.
You should see him do this with Grog's ooks and bobs his head and rattles beads until they headbutt him.
Patterson ran through a flowchart of questions regarding his treatment. Valentine denied being harmed or humiliated after his surrender.
Captain Sagamoto is on his way. He'll verify your credentials and then we'll be done with you. Hope you're telling the truth, because otherwise...
Lieutenant, don't terrify the prisoner. I'll have to log that.
I beg your pardon.
Whether the lieutenant spoke to him or Patterson, Valentine couldn't tell. He backed off, and a five-striper nudged him.
Don't let it bother you, sir. Just a bunch of papers.
Patterson had the lieutenant sign a piece of paper, and while they were so occupied, the sergeant knelt down behind Valentine and checked his bonds.
Inside, if they ask you where you comes from, say Canada. Make up some small place nobody ever heards of, like Moose Dick or Fragilocious.
The sergeant stood up as soon as the officers turned.
Just making sure I could wiggle a finger through.
Valentine's ears picked up a faint whine and wheels turning on the landing strip. A golf cart-like vehicle emerged from between two fuselages and joined the party, parking next to the autogyro. Like Patterson, the driver was on the lean side. His margarine clothes were thin and seemed hardly enough to keep out the dry wind. They reminded Valentine of the hospital gowns he'd seen at Xanadu. He had faintly Eurasian features and a growth of beard that made him look like a model from one of the old magazines, trying to look rugged and fresh off a mountain.
I'm Captain Sagamoto.
He nodded to the lieutenant.
Patterson, I don't think this'll concern you. Can the newcomer and I have a moment?
He squatted down opposite Valentine as the others moved away. Valentine ran through the signs and countersigns he'd memorized back at Nancy's. Finally, Sagamoto extended his left fist.
Red to blue.
Negative, negative, negative. Sorry, I can't lock knuckles.
Sagamoto smiled.
I can see that. Prefix 209.
Suffix V, April 27. I'm here to see Senator Bay from the illustrious state of Oklahoma.
Sagamoto stood.
Lieutenant, he's cleared. I'm going to ask you to use your comm set. I'm taking him to the inside. Patterson, aren't you needed in the marshes? I heard a team of Grogs got captured after the fighting. You pedal hard, you'll be there to make sure they're tucked in tonight and get properly exchanged. Might win you that promotion back to the inside.
Barbarians.
The sergeant cut Valentine's bonds, and he and the corporal lifted him. Everyone watched Patterson bike away.
I didn't know about no fighting in the marshes.
I could have heard wrong. You know how rumors fly in there.